Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Thursday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer at the New York Stock Exchange. David Faber's at Citigroup headquarters today. He'll have an exclusive with CEO Jane Fraser later on this hour. In the meantime, pre-market trying to hold yesterday's rally as Fed Chair Powell heads to the Senate for day two. Another round of talks in progress between Russia and Ukraine. But meanwhile, as you just heard, oil is backing off this morning's high of 116, the highest since 08. Our roadmap begins with Fed Chair Powell calming some rate hike fears. Futures look to extend yesterday's rally. Citi shares are under some pressure. David will sit down exclusively with Fraser, pitching her growth strategy to transform that company. And Snowflake shares tumbling on slowing revenue growth and the guidance, although in line, we'll talk to Jim about it, disappoints. We'll begin with market volatility, though, after the rally yesterday, Jim. It really started the moment Powell endorsed 25, and we never looked back.
Right. Well, one of the things that Powell did wrong when he first came in was he talked about automatic lockstep. And he just said, we're not going to be an autopilot. I thought that was the most important thing, not the 25 basis, because what that says is, okay, look, big bad event. I just took it out. I'm not going to say anything that makes it so that you're going to be thinking that every month we're going to have them. There's a bunch of people who came on our air and said that, which then gave a lot of analysts cover to be able to come out today. I mean, I've never read so many positive notes at some weird moment at the beginning of March than this morning. Everybody's out saying, listen, you got to buy them. So the futures even turned just on the analyst notes.
Yeah. Citi upgrading U.S. and specifically tech.
I thought that was a great upgrade because they basically said, look, the multiple shrinkage is now over. We've got the Fed doing what it's going to do. Things have really come down, and we're going to talk about Snowflake. So buy. It was a very significant note. It turned around a lot of the semis.
And then, of course, the Squawk Gang was just talking about oil a moment ago. There is some speculation that an Iranian deal could happen within, say, 72 hours.
Well, that's a very interesting call. I've got Rick Moncrief, who I think is the dean of the group now. He's the CEO of Devon, is talking about how, look, we're just making so much money, but got to figure out whether to be disciplined. So I think, David, I know that you are at a place where they have an international perspective. Maybe Jane Fraser is able to talk about what's going on in the world because she has got the most far-flung network, say, of all the banks.
Yeah, Citi does. And we'll talk a bit about Russian exposure, although, frankly, it's fairly minimal in terms of the percentage of their assets, 0.3%. Not the main focus for us here at Citi headquarters when we get started with Jane later in the hour. Jim, you know, when it comes to banks, actually, I think it's the European banks, and I assume you've been hearing the same, that people are a bit concerned about. For any number of reasons. And obviously, even the Swiss banks, you know, you go after all those oligarchs. I don't know what their assets look like, but they got to be coming down fast. And I don't know what the liability side of their balance sheet looks like, but they owe that money to somebody.
Yeah, this is a used yacht problem. Although I'm told by in the used yacht market, believe it or not, they held up. Now, I wish I were being facetious, but
France,
it obviously is a major issue.
France this morning seized the yacht of the Rosneft oligarch. And a lot of them are parked in the Maldives, which doesn't have an extradition treaty.
No, the Maldives are really caught. They're really caught between Romania and Ukraine, and they know that Russia at any moment could invade them. So they've been holding off. But I think that, look, there's no doubt about it that David's right. People are trying to describe a 2011 situation where we have all these banks in Europe that are really kind of struggling, and they sell all our banks. That turned out to be a terrible call. The banks over there are far more, well, no, let's put that, we're more insulated from Europe than any. Like I think Santander is very interesting down here. But not Credit Suisse. They have historically been not great in these, not Deutsche Bank. But, I got to tell you, Carl, what the hell are we doing selling some of the brokerage stocks here because of what's going over there? And that's just the ETFization that we've had to deal with because the big firms just insist on doing ETFs because they need to make money. It's not a con game. but we should expose it for what it is. People putting together baskets in order to make a little extra money.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk to David in a second here about Citi, which, by the way, gets some negative calls out today out of KBW and Atlantic on expenses, on the prolonged outlook for better returns, on Russia exposure, on selling Mexico.
Yeah, David, the notes today make it so that you feel that the tangible book value of Citi is maybe, I'm not saying overstated because that would be wrong, but maybe too aggressive. How about that? And David, I've got to tell you, this bank, people keep saying is cheap, but it's always been cheap. What can she do to close the gap?
Well, whatever it is that Jane Fraser is going to do is going to take time. And that was, I think, a clear part of the presentation yesterday. It ended up being a virtual investor day. Originally was scheduled to be in person. But, Jim, you know, that may have been what was something of a disappointment, the 3 to 5 year time frame for getting to that 11 to 12% ROTCE. At the same time, during the course of the day yesterday, as you know, the stock did start to recover as each of the managers made presentations in their particular areas. And so perhaps a bit more confidence. But we're going to have an opportunity to talk through a lot of this. To your point, you know, maybe you don't think book value is quite where it is, but right now a lot of analysts have it at 75% of book value. But it's been trading below book for a long time, and that is one of the challenges here, is to sort of either get those investors who've been there a long time and are like had enough to exit and really try and start to build a new investor base based on the promises that were made yesterday.
Well, you need to see major buyback, David. And I've got to tell you, 3 to 5 years, that kind of reminds me, Carl, of the Morgan Stanley downgrade of Intel today to sell. Why? Wide open, multiple years that they have to try to catch up. Multiple year doesn't hit, you know, I don't want multiple year. I want multiple quarters, and then I'm okay. And even there, American Eagle Outfitters, which is owned by my charitable trust, they're talking about multiple quarters, and I don't have time for that. I don't.
Because there are too many other options in the shorter term?
Look, we're going to win a Super Bowl. Give us 5 years. No, you don't have that luxury. You got a quarter, two quarters. David, we don't have time for multiple years. We're in the here and now, David.
Well, is that just because we're old? Do you mean that we don't have time, Jim? Or we're running out of time investors have no patience?
Investors have no patience. And we certainly don't have any patience for Citi, which continues to make miscues, David, over and over. The Mexican miscue. I mean, I don't understand that at all.
Well, listen, those were confronted yesterday in a very significant way, I think. And I thought that was an interesting part of the investor day. And again, we'll have that opportunity to talk it over with Jane. But when it comes to a lack of patience, Jim, I'm kind of curious. So I know we're going to talk about Snowflake in a little bit. But so these high multiple stocks, people don't seem to have a lot of patience for any longer either, even with only 25 basis points promised now by the Fed chair very soon. But the prospect, I guess, of I don't even know how many rate hikes will come during the course of the rest of the year.
Well, we are seeing a bifurcation. Okta, Viva, you know, I had Okta on last night. Todd McKinnon, just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 price target lowerings. Because why? Because they're actually losing more money than we thought. Now, Snowflake's harder because they have a different kind of accounting. It's straightforward accounting, but you can't really pin down Snowflake as doing badly. They did have a January that wasn't that good. But I would tell you, and Carl, I know Frank Slootman for many, many years, Snowflake's a buy. Because the actual progression of margins is what you need to look at, and the net retention, which is over 170%, which is extraordinary. It does sell at 25 times sales, which is high, but it did sell at 100 times sales. This is not Zoom, which sold at 50 times sales and then ends up telling it 12 times earnings. This is a real company with real growth, still perhaps the best. He did guide down to 68% growth. I think that's going to be under promise, and he will over-deliver.
Yeah, it sort of gets us back to the method of guidance in this particular tape, and that is, what's the upside of over-promising right now?
Zero.
Yeah.
There's no upside. Now, Box under-promised, and Aaron, you know, Levy, and then he over-delivered, and Box is flying. But yeah, I urge people to listen to Frank and Frank Slootman and what he says. He's got a business model that is, by the way, you kind of rent the cloud. So unlike Mark Benioff, where you give $100 million to at the beginning of the year and it's ratable, he has to deal with customers that they come and go, but he hasn't really lost anybody. So I think that Snowflake being for sale is an opportunity. What, David, Snowflake, this is Frank Slootman we're talking about, David. This isn't some hack.
I understand. I know, but you liked it yesterday, you liked it higher, and saying something's down from 100 times sales to 25 is not necessarily a great endorsement, Jim. I mean, it could easily go to 10 times sales. Why not?
Well, okay, I'll play that game. David, earlier I said that Jane Fraser, I was not going to give her time because I think that there's structural issues. I'm willing to give Frank Slootman time because every time I've given time in the last 15 years, he's paid off. But you're absolutely right. My charitable trust does not own it because I feared that it was selling at too high a multiple, but not anymore. Now I'm looking, trying to figure out whether this belongs in a charitable trust. Carl, when you see some of these stocks on a discount and they have actual margins getting better, and you know, look, Snowflake, I mean, let's deal with some reality here. What did Snowflake do? Okay, over and over and over again, the quarters have been better and better and better. They were negative 105% on the margins 3 years ago. Then they were negative 38 2 years ago. Then they were negative 3 last year. And now they're positive 5 in the fourth quarter. They have an earnings breakout coming, and people don't see it. Why don't they see it? Because they are impatient.
Would you say the same thing about Splunk? Which, by the way...
Oh, Gary Steele.
Crushes.
Gary Steele. Okay, so first of all, proof point. Gary Steele has been on Mad Money, I don't know, a dozen times. He took proof point from a second-rate email security to being one of the great cybersecurity companies. He comes into Splunk. Buy Splunk. Great quarter. And Gary Steele? Gary Steele's a great turnaround artist. He's a great operator. David, sometimes you have to, this is why I did it with Slootman, sometimes you have to say that the CEOs deliver. And it's in tech that we feel that way. By the way, Pat Gelsinger, he was right after the Ukraine ambassador.
You give him your nice guy. I know, Pat Gelsinger. He gets the nice guy.
Extremely
he stood.
Nice guy.
He got a nice applause.
Yeah.
$100 billion. I'm still waiting for that
billion.
Number.
He went from billion. 20 billion to 100 billion. Yeah. How about 200 billion? I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But he's really nice. So let's just knock off the criticism, okay? Just knock it off. Like my Nana Mary. If you don't have anything good to say, don't say it.
Yeah. It's
one day you're going to start feeling better about Intel. Yeah.
I used to be an Intel hog. I'm recovered.
Well, and now we've got this Apple event coming up on the 8th. And who knows what they'll say about a new M chip, right, Jim? Is they go further vertical on semis?
Well, I got to tell you, I just think that there was a note today about Qorvo saying that Qorvo may not make the quarter because there's a Chinese glut. And I think about that. And I was at Bar San Miguel last night. And I don't like Qorvo, and I don't like Qorvo.
Qorvo?
They're both cheap booze.
We'll take a break here. There's a lot to get to. Obviously, we'll get to Best Buy, do a little bit more on what Frank Slootman told Jim last night about Snow on Mad Money. Oil has really turned on some of these speculative reports about a potential Iranian deal. And of course, we got Powell coming up on the Senate side in about 45 minutes. Don't go away.
The mood to the market is a little foul right now for good reasons. A quarter is a single mile marker in the marathon. Let's not get too excited here. We're in the beginning innings of an enormous opportunity and transformation in the economy. And, this is going to be a blip on the radar, pretty soon.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Shares of Best Buy are up in the pre-market. Quarterly earnings in line. Revenues and comps missed. They were hurt by some supply chain and Omicron issues. Company also announces this div hike, 26%, Jim, a $5 billion buyback.
Corey Barry's doing some amazing things, the CEO there. And one of the things I really like, I know short term, 16.3 billion versus 16.5, forget that. What matters here is a tremendous buyback, $5 billion. That's a huge percentage of the company. It's a dividend hike of 26%. I am using, as Dave Costin did today from Goldman, really looking at these dividend hikes now that we know what the Fed's going to be up to. I think that she has this thing on a long-term growth path that says buy. You just buy it. Because very few people have a calendar 2024 outlook. She has it. Most people are afraid of giving anything more than a quarter outlook. This stock should be bought. I think that she's in there buying it. You should be in there buying it. It's a very impressive long-term view.
Why are we seeing so much retail weakness? Again, in specialty, AEO, Burl, BJ, all going to open down big today.
Right. Well, AEO is uniquely disappointing to me. They used Vietnam, and Vietnam had COVID. They couldn't get stuff in time for Christmas, so they ended up flying it in. Cost them $80 million. They're spending a fortune on an infrastructure project that I don't think is necessarily paying off. They talked about having to be promotional because they have too much inventory. And they said the first half is going to be miserable. Now, all that together put together says, what the hell did I buy this thing for my trust? And the answer is not the dividend, but because I thought they'd put this together. And it's just plain out disappointing. And their arrogance in the call of not acknowledging any of this, I thought was shameful. Just shameful. I mean, who do they think they are?
Do you think we're going to have real consumer weakness? You think all those, that inventory is going to have to be marked down? I mean, in aggregate. Industry.
I think that, no. I mean, look, if you knew what you were doing, like Costco, like Rich Galanti, who's the CFO, runs the call. If you knew what you were doing, you ordered correctly and you got it. If you didn't know what you were doing and you sourced from Vietnam, I know Gary Friedman's been having some problems sourcing Vietnam. They did not get COVID right. You sourced from Vietnam and it was on the boat. Then you couldn't put it on the boat. You put it on the plane. Put it on the plane, it cost too much. You missed the season, and now you're stuck with inventory, even though Aerie is doing very well. And I happen to like their stuff. I got a big box of it in my closet waiting to give it to my daughter at some point. But I this was one of those calls. It was otherworldly. I mean, when you go out there and you say, listen, yo, I'm going to miss the first half, and you kind of congratulate yourself, what the heck are you thinking? I'm putting this in the... Look, this guy's nearing the wall of shame. If they blow it in the second half of next year, wall of shame. And that's reserved usually for things like ATT, where someone said Catalyst buy. Did you see that? I wish David were in this block, because I would have to say David.
He'll be back, but Morgan Stanley.
Morgan Stanley had a lot of notes. They wrote a lot. And, of course, Jonas wrote 43 notes. Does he ever? He's like, who is he? He's like, Edgar Allan Poe. He's got like a little poem every night.
Some of them are just transcripts of fireside chats.
Aren't they?
Yes.
I tried to get one of the fireside chats. And do you know that their compliance blocked me?
Interesting.
Yeah, isn't that something?
We'll get you.
It was going to be virtual. I don't know. I mean, I felt like lighting the whole thing on fire. Put a little gasoline on that fire.
We will get David back this morning because he's got an exclusive, as we said, with Citi's Jane Fraser. We've also got Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester and Exxon's Darren Woods as we see crude oil come off of the early morning highs. Take one more look here at the pre-market as we brace for Powell Day 2 in a moment. More Squawk on the Street after a break.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Time now for Cramer's Mad Dash as we count down to the opening bell. Kroger's going to open at a 52-week high.
Some people thought that Rodney McMullen, the CEO, was too nice. People said that. People said he was too folksy. People said he was too at home. Every one of those is working. Everything he did is paying off. He has turned out to have a supermarket that uniquely is used to cook at home. And it's an exciting place to go. I've got to hand it to him. Now, the Kroger number, 91 versus 72, compare that to the BJ's number. I'm not going to compare it to American Eagle Alpha, because I'm too upset. and then a two-year stack of digital, 113%. Kroger is just cooking with propane. And I really want to congratulate McMullen, because, when I first time he laid it out to me, he laid out the vision, I said, Al, nice guy. You know, I mean, but I usually, when I say nice guy, that's usually bad.
Yes.
No, nice guy, good. This guy's a nice guy, finished first story. By the way, this is a supermarket chain. Unlike Albertsons, where they're like worried they can't get their multiple up. Well, how about you offer what he's doing? Cook at home, staying, got staying power.
Why is this working thematically when the whole environment we're in is people going out, COVID, Google searches going to post-pandemic lows?
Well, I think that some of it is that he's made it so that you feel like it's your local Kroger. They put some local stuff in, Cincinnati-based, but that's why I say folksy. I just think that what Rodney's doing is made it a much more exciting place to go. It reminds me, by the way, of the Reading Terminal in Philadelphia, where you just say, wow, you know what? Here's a steak sandwich. Here's this and that. And it worked. I thought it was pie in the sky. Not unlike Target, when he said, listen, we're going to have five different kinds of Target. And by the way, Brian Cornell, another nice guy. What's it with the nice guys finishing first, Carl? What is this about?
It sort of collides with the Domino's story this week as well, right? And that is, you exit the pandemic, you want to bring some of that with you.
Yeah.
And Domino's hasn't been able to.
I've been texting to the new CEO of Domino's, and I think I have to have the pizza no cheese with banana peppers tonight because the quarter's got to get better.
No. We're going to watch Kroger, of course, and some of the other consumer names as we get the opening bell, followed by David's exclusive with Citi and Jane Fraser. We're back in a moment.
We're never on autopilot, obviously. And at a time like this, what we aim to do is lay out our principles and then, with whatever clarity we do have, and then proceed to implement them, those policies, carefully and nimbly. I do think it will be appropriate to raise our target range for the federal funds rate at the March meeting in a couple of weeks. And I'm inclined to propose and support a 25 basis point rate hike.
That's the Fed chair yesterday during the House Financial Services hearing, talking about 25 in March, which he would be inclined to propose and support. He did say if it runs hot and inflation runs hotter, you could be more aggressive. And that's why the CPI, the next CPI print is going to be key.
Absolutely. And also wages tomorrow. Now, can I just say that when Powell speaks, people should start thinking that this man is far better. He's a bit of, now when we used to have Greenspan would speak and he would try to befuddle us, this is the opposite. He gives you great clarity. He makes you feel like, you know what, it's under control. He even handles any question about transitory. They try to get him. They do rope-a-dope, you know. And unlike Frazier, who went down to Ali, he's more Ali. He really, he does sting like a bee. And why he does that is because if you get into his crosshairs and saying he didn't get it right, he says, well, why can't I still get it right? And all these people say he's behind the curve. That man was not behind the curve. That man was a guy who was very thoughtful about COVID, very thoughtful about what's going to happen in the world, and by the way, including Russia.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. We knew we could be wrong, and I always thought we could pivot pretty quickly and catch up.
Right.
In the meantime, the economy healed quickly. We know what our job is now, which is to move away from these highly accommodative settings. He's like, we gave it a chance, right? And it didn't work, and so we move on.
Right. I mean, why? He does something that most, he's not a politician. He basically said, look, I got it wrong. So he's not afraid of YouTube, where we just endlessly do a TikTok, you know, or YouTube TikTok about I got it wrong, No. And I just thought it was pure joy, because what he said is, here's what we did. Here's why we have to pivot. Move on with your life. We got it under control. And I think a lot of people come on our show and they want to talk about it endlessly. I say, I have one word for them. Stop. It's done. He told you what's going to happen, and now go buy stocks.
Let's start by getting the opening bell and the CNBC real-time exchange. At the big board today, it's ICL Group, a specialty minerals company celebrating its 30th listing anniversary. At the NASDAQ, it's WiseKey, a cybersecurity and NFT platform.
Oh, man. Okay. Look, I want to go back and talk about why I like Splunk. Splunk is cybersecurity. Splunk's also a company that gives you a great dashboard analysis of how you're doing. And my fear is that it was leaderless. Okay? Doug Merritt left. We still don't know why he left. When you get a guy like Steele in there, what it says, and I am trying to get him on the show tonight. Maybe you can get him on Tech Check. What he did at Proofpoint was prove people wrong over and over and over again. That's what he's going to do at Splunk. Splunk's a buy, and I've disliked Splunk for a long time.
Yeah, well, we're going to get a little bit move in that direction beginning today, given the quarter. Interesting, we got a lot of travel on the move. MGM with a new buyback,
yes.
With some extensions of licenses in Macau. Airlines got an upgrade to Southwest today.
Wow, I thought that was gutsy. I mean, we know that these planes, look, they run on jet fuel, for heaven's sake. I don't want to touch those. I do not want to touch the airlines. They're just too dumb. Why do you have to go there? I mean, when I saw that upgrade, I said, why? Can you just sit on your hands? Why don't you sit on your hands? Why do you have to say anything? The guy's on an intellectual vacation. Maybe he should go on a real vacation.
You think because oil has a more prolonged headwind?
Unless, like, maybe he's betting on, maybe he knows about an Iranian deal where they're allowed to have nukes in return for oil. Yeah. I don't think he has that kind of prescience, frankly.
Actually, it's interesting. Citi put on an oil short of December crude back on the 7th of February. Today they unwind it. They're like, this Ukraine thing has made it too difficult to keep up. There'll be a better chance to short oil in the coming month.
We're seeing some towels being thrown. I happen to think when I hear what Rick Moncrief says tomorrow and Devin at our club call at 12:30, if he says, look, we're turning on the jets, everybody's drilling, taking advantage of it, then there is a chance that we go back under, let's say, 100. I'm not banking on it, though. And I'm not banking on Iran to be able to just, you know, just kind of turn on the jets either.
Right.
I think people have to recognize that we don't know. Brian Sullivan did this great thing. He was like tracking 8 tankers of oil. We don't know where it's going, but one thing we know is we need it.
As we get into summer driving season, and by the way, the readout of this phone call this morning between Putin and Macron, according to the wires, French officials saying there was nothing encouraging in what Putin had to say.
Well, I mean, I still go back to who Putin thought he was going to liberate Ukraine from: drug addicts and Nazis. And, you know, if you want drug addicts, thank you, Sacklers, right? Thank you, oxycodone. We had a problem with drug addicts. I'm talking about Purdue. And Nazis, you know, you go back to Zelensky, he had 3 uncles who were murdered in the Holocaust. So the Nazi thing doesn't work for me.
Not really. Although, Jim, energy is the only sector down today.
Well, there you go. I mean, people just are anxious to take profits. Go ahead. Go sell Chevron stock to Mike Wirth, who could buy up to 25% of the company. You know, look, everything can cut. It's up on a spike. Maybe you know this move is not just Iran. This is a move which says that Putin might go. And I don't see Putin. No, he's the president for life. His term, it would be different. If his term were suspended, it would not be good for him.
All right. Speaking of selling shares of the company, how about this deal that John Foley of Peloton has made to sell $50 million worth to this Dell-backed office?
Well, first of all, you never sell to Dell, because then you're selling to Greg Lemkow and to Michael Dell. Second, you never sell when you have Barry McCarthy come in. So I wonder whether John Foley doesn't owe some money. I don't know. We should ask John. I happen to like John very much, and you know why. He's a nice guy.
You're using that with machine gun pattern today.
Well,
a nice guy.
I like Foley. I mean, I was at a dinner with Foley where he basically said that I was, you know, public enemy number one. But then he's added he's joking.
You know, right. Joking. we did get some affirmation of guidance, Jim, out of Honeywell today.
Longer-term guide up.
Yep.
Now, my Chapel Trust owns it forever, and I had spent some time with Dave Cote recently, who, by the way, is doing a lot more at Vertiv ever since the Vertiv come down. And he gave me tremendous comfort for Darius. And we're talking about Darius and Damchek. If you want a superior industrial that could do it better, if you think that the airline's going to be filled with new planes, and he's got a lot of good businesses, and he's always up to one thing. He's got a great buyback. He has a tremendous firepower. I say my trust owns Honeywell. It's been buying it right here, but people say, hey, well, Jim, you bought it higher and lower. I bought it all over the place. Why? Because I have faith in Adamczyk. I have faith in Adamczyk, in Slootman, in Steele. I like certain Corey Barry at Best Buy, McMullen at Kroger. We are seeing an ascendancy of CEOs who know how to be in control. And again, I know people want to sell Snowflake. I know people are burying Slootman. You bury him at your own risk.
We're seeing Snowflake obviously down at the open. On an index level, Jim, 4405 is going to take us all the way back to the 20th of February.
A lot of my smartest guys say this is where we peak and start going down.
Really?
That we can't penetrate this level.
What do you think?
I think we're uneven. I think we're hostage to events. I think that we are no longer in the buy the dips. That just completely failed. But we still could be in the sell some of the rips. I'm urging people to not sell oil. Because you sell oil, what you're betting is we've made a deal with Iran. You can have nuclear power. We'll take your oil. And if Biden does that, that's not good for Biden. I think that that's a bad trade-off for Biden.
Well, he's under pressure to block Russian oil imports, and he's going to be under pressure because retail gas is going to go to four.
Yeah, people are asking me, why did this happen? Okay, so we built all these refineries to handle heavy crude, which was coming from Canada via Keystone. Yeah. So we blocked Keystone. So we have the wrong refineries. We are moving our light crude to Europe and other places because we don't have that refinery capacity. And we're taking Russian and other bad crude and fixing it. It's a mismatch caused by the wrong refineries. And people stop me and say, Jim, is it true that we're taking Russian oil? Well, we didn't in February, but we did take 400,000 barrels a day in December.
Right. And that's not a lot given total consumption.
No, and Mike Wirth was saying, look, it's all fungible where it comes from. But yeah. You have to understand, we built refineries to handle Canadian crude, and then we didn't build the pipeline to do it. It's kind of like in Poltergeist when they moved the headstones, but they didn't move the bodies.
Right, yeah. It sort of reminds us of what Germany said today about their own nat gas costs have now gone 2x. And if you look at the spread, Jim, between 2 years in Europe and here, it's the widest since early 2020.
Predicted by Sharif Suki, the man who built Cheniere and is now building Tellurian. That's a very speculative stock. Be careful. It does need some money in order to be able to build out. We do not have enough build out. We can ship up to 12 million. Well, it's a unit that we have to sell to Europe. But a lot of it's already been committed to Korea, to China. We can't help them other than sending our liquefied natural gas to Poland. Right. We don't have enough space.
But doesn't it set up a scenario where our central bank has clearance to hike and the ECB does not?
Yes.
And the sort of what asymmetry that will build in?
Yes. Our 12 billion BCF, we also have enough natural gas to light up the country. And the only reason why we're sending, by the way, we sent a lot of Russian crude to Boston because we can't get the pipelines there because it's been blocked by the environmentalists. Now, I'm not saying good or bad. I am saying if you want to know why Russian crude is here, it's because we don't have pipelines to where we thought we were going to. But we have so much natural gas. Mike Wirth, by the way, has enough natural gas in Marcellus to take care of our heating needs.
Yeah. If you just look at the list of losers this morning, defense once again.
Yeah.
And a lot of energy-related names, SLB, Oxy's in there. I mean, looking at the tape, you would think the market's optimistic about some near-term resolution.
It sure does. Now, remember, we at the State of the Union, we did not hear Biden talk about arming Ukraine with our classic missiles that we have, including the excellent Javelin, which can wipe out a tank rather easily. Tanks are no longer invincible. But I also think that this rumor of Iran just shows you that when you have a parabolic move for oil, not unlike what we had in August of 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, that on day three of that invasion, you had oil starting to come down. It was really interesting.
You think it's related to, I mean, and again, a lot of this is just fog of war reporting, but the way in which their convoy is stalled north of Kyiv, where it's very muddy.
Right.
They don't have great tires. It means they have to take the roads, which limits a lot of Putin's options.
The rainy season isn't supposed to be to the fall.
Yep.
So Putin got that wrong, too. He got the weather wrong. I mean, he needs I saw Al Roker the other day talking about you're no longer just like a stand-up guy. He needed a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. He got Dylan wrong. But I think that everything that Putin has done so far is wrong. And by the way, when you hit civilian, when you hit hospitals, we do have Facebook. Now, a lot of the armchair generals say, war is not won by Facebook. That's a mistake. When Switzerland, which is historically rogue, Switzerland had no problem with Nazis.
Yeah.
But, they had no problem with Nazis and their bank accounts, but not Russians.
No. And more companies pulling out today, MSCI, stocks, Deutsche Börse, London Stock Exchange, and others. Takes us to Citi this morning. As we said, David's at Citi headquarters with Jane Fraser. Hey, David.
Hey, Carl, that's right. Not too far from you guys at the New York Stock Exchange, but very happy to be here at Citi's headquarters at 388 Granite Street and be joined by its CEO, Jane Fraser. Nice to see people walking around in the background as well. Jane, I've been in the building not that long ago when it was quite different. And I'm sure nice for you as well. Thank you for having us here.
Oh, thank you so much. And yes, it is. It's wonderful to feel the vibrancy and life back in New York City
yes.
again.
A little bit of life. Well, yesterday as well, you had an important day, which was your investor day. You've been in the job for 1 year. Somewhat muted response from at least the analyst community to what you presented yesterday. A long road for improved returns. Patience required. Are you happy with sort of the response that you've gotten? Is that the message you wanted to send, that this is going to take time?
Yes, I'm very positive about the response we got. What we wanted to do yesterday was provide clarity to our investors, to the street, about the vision we have for Citi, the strategy, and our execution plan. And I think yesterday was successful in achieving that. We've been hard at work for a year, so it's a culmination of the work of a year, and be able to provide that simply, straightforwardly, and we will now focus on executing.
Well, executing is obviously going to be the key, but you know, there are those who say 3 to 5 years to get to an 11 to 12% ROTCE is longer than we might have thought. What do you say to those who question whether the timeline perhaps is going to be a bit too long, and try the patience of some of your investors?
Yeah, I have certainly had big years listening to our investors. And so we've taken a big step back when we set the vision, we set the strategy for the firm to be a longer term vision and strategy and plan. We've taken a number of bold moves already in terms of the divestitures of a number of our historically iconic franchises to really focus Citi around our core strengths. We've taken strategic bets in businesses that we've got a high confidence and excitement about around growth. But this is an organic growth strategy. It will take time. And I want to be completely transparent and realistic around what it's going to take. And it is going to take a few years for us to achieve the medium-term targets. I absolutely aspire for higher returns, and I'm confident we'll get that in the longer run. But right now, I'm focused on the job in hand.
Yeah, and I want to talk a bit more about that. But to that idea of at least meeting those targets, you know, I'm reading a note here from Goldman Sachs. One of the key questions, and you got this yesterday as well during the presentation's Q&A, you know, the execution of the plan, will it be different than 4 years ago when, or 5 years ago, when Citi largely missed most of the original targets set out at a 2017 investor day? You know, again, this idea of why should we believe Citi now when the company did not deliver on its previous targets?
We have a very, very credible plan. It's one that's grounded in a simpler Citi, and you can see that. We're focused on five core businesses. Our vision goes back to our core competitive strengths and capabilities, which is being a focus around clients with global needs and being their trusted partner. We are the preeminent global bank in that respect. So I strongly believe in simplicity and focus. And so that is the bank today. It is a simpler bank. It is a more focused one. It's going to be much better connected. And in addition to that, what we've then looked at is, as I said yesterday to our investors, we took a step back and we looked at what are the different issues that have held us back, and we are addressing them full on.
Yeah, you were somewhat unsparing in your criticism. I mean, I think, quoting you, somewhat disadvantaged business mix. We avoided making some hard decisions. We did not invest enough. How was that received amongst many of the people here who perhaps were here years ago during the course of course, some of these mistakes being made?
I think the important piece is that we laid out the vision for what we are going to be. And it's a realistic one that takes into account what are some of the elements of culture or our operating model, investments that we haven't made enough of. And it laid out the vision of what the future is going to be, because I think that's the most important piece, is acknowledging what's held us back, but what are we doing about them? And then where are we headed to?
So what would be an example of a hard decision that was avoided that you've confronted head on and that you can show as an example of now doing so?
The divestiture of our consumer businesses in the retail banks in Asia and in Mexico is an example of one, or the wind down of our business in Korea. That then enables us to have a much simpler organization structure. It enables us to have a business mix of businesses that fit perfectly well together with a lot of synergies for the shareholders. So those decisions are actually enabling us to much better position the bank for the future and to make the investments we need to and make strategic bets that are ones we're excited about, we have high conviction behind.
Right. Now, obviously, you did say you didn't invest enough, and now you would obviously assume, we would assume that you think you are investing enough.
Yes.
How much more are you going to invest? I know just $11 billion in technology alone, both for changing the bank and just running the bank.
Yes. Look at the world today. The scaling up and the speed and scale of business is extraordinary. So if I look at our crown jewel business, which is our transaction businesses, so think of payments, liquidity management and working capital for any company. We're double the size of our nearest competitor in terms of serving those companies around the world with our network. 95 countries, people on the ground, knowledge of everything that's going on. We're investing in a capability that will increase our scale by 100-fold. And that is putting us in a position for the digital age and that scale, speed and agility that's required. Those are investments I'm really excited about because as we've done with City Velocity, City Direct and others, we've led the industry. And this will be another example of where we shall do so again.
All right. But to the extent there was historical underinvestment, again, something you said, and now you've increased that. It's not to expect, though, that there's going to be near-term revenue benefits, right? It's going to take quite some time, isn't it?
I'm quite optimistic around the revenue benefits that we'll see sooner rather than later on this. And we've got a plan that's really a question of when, not if, we'll realize the growth that we've laid out. So if I look at different dimensions of it, we will get a recovery in the consumer here in the States. We're seeing enormous growth in the client base that need our global services and capabilities, another growth driver, particularly in the middle market. And we have a commercial bank, 30 different countries around the world serving these middle market companies who have global needs. And we see it every day. Look how many born digital players are that are born global at the same time. They need us, they use us. And we had the pleasure of hearing from Google, Flywire, and a number of our clients about how central City is in it. So I'm confident.
Beyond the bigger ROTCE, which everybody's going to be focused on in terms of quarter to quarter or year to year, what else would you argue is how you should be held accountable in terms of some of the progress you're talking about being made from these investments?
Yes, we laid out yesterday a strategy which will drive financial outcomes, and we laid out a number of the different metrics which will be there. Some of those ones are related to synergies that we realize. How well are we referring clients from our private bank to the commercial bank? How well are we growing clients from the commercial bank up to the corporate bank? What are we doing in terms of cross-selling our services clients into our markets capability with foreign exchange? So these synergies are very important ones that we haven't done as strong a job in the past that are examples of the types of metrics you'll see. You'll see ones around revenue growth and how well we're doing in terms of acquiring new clients. Wealth management, we brought in 400 new advisors last year, despite a pretty hot labor market and talent market out there. How are we doing in translating that into new clients that are joining our platforms? So these are the types of strategic drivers that will give our investors a sense of, is a strategy working? And then will it deliver the financial outcomes afterwards?
Something else hired is a lot of software engineers. I think you have 30,000 is what you said. What are they all doing?
Oh, they are busy coding. So as we look at some of the areas we had underinvested in was really our end-to-end processes. So we're making sure that we're digitizing end-to-end our processes to cope with that scale that we're talking about, that 100-time scale. We have them working in putting different capabilities on the cloud. They're helping with data. They're also connecting us to other institutions, as being a bank for banks is part of the strategy, and the APIs are key there.
Yeah.
So they're really embedded in the business. They're almost more frontline than they are the traditional view of a technologist.
Although if I know software engineers, probably most of them are not in this building. They may be working from home, right? No.
No, because they actually do enjoy social interaction.
They do, software engineers.
Yes, who knew that?
I'm kidding. You got asked a few times, and you answered this in a sense as to why you're still in consumer banking. I mean, to the extent that people know Citi, they may know it as a result of your branches.
Yeah.
But I guess, why should you remain in what we call personal banking here in the United States?
Yeah, it's our home market. We serve almost 75 million customers today. And we're one of the leading consumer lending franchises here in the States. It's a very important engine for us. It's got attractive returns. We've put a lot of investment over the years into digitizing it. And we're excited about both the growth and return prospects there and continuing to be a leader in it. So this is a core part of Citi's identity in the States. Good connectivity with other businesses.
Right. Well, as you say, one of its key parts of its identity is as a global bank, which brings me to current events, unfortunate events as they are. Your Russian exposure, to the extent you have it, something like $9.6 billion, about 0.3% of your assets. What are the expectations there? Is there going to be a write-off in Citi's future for those assets?
The situation's very, very fluid at the moment all of the world, frankly, at the moment, right now. We are more focused on the humanitarian components. I have 200 people in Ukraine who this morning opened our bank and continued helping our clients there with payroll, with food supply, with the supply chains, and bringing some of the humanitarian aid. The people are extraordinary. They're just on a mission to try and make sure that we're able to support the country for as long as we can.
Is business still running there?
As I say, it's more focused on humanitarian. It's more focused on food supply and on critical supply chains. They're in the country. I don't think any of us know how long we'll be able to keep going, but we are determined to do everything we can to support the country. And then in terms of Russia, what we're seeing there is there is a big unwind going for across different industries. A lot of our investors, our corporate clients are looking at what their own exposures, how do they reduce those down? Where are we going to see a decoupling of the Russian capital market, financial markets, and broader economy
from
the rest of the world?
Anything you're concerned about in terms of being destabilizing, or any concern for potentially the European banks that may bore more of the brunt of some of those unwinds?
I think we're all more worried about the humanitarian side right now than the financial exposures. For us, as I say, it's 0.3%. It matters, but there are other things that are more critical. Our teams are actively managing down the exposures that we've got, but we're also very much focused on serving our clients and helping them adjust to this extraordinary and horrific situation.
Yeah, it certainly is. Another concern, of course, has been cyber. The U.S. government has made that very clear. Are you surprised that perhaps there hasn't been as much as might have been anticipated? And how focused are you? And is the U.S. government, by the way, to the extent they're in touch with you on this matter in terms of protecting our financial institutions?
I think if you ask any head of a bank or head of any of the power companies, telcos, and major private infrastructure, this is probably our primary concern is cyber right now domestically. We don't know what's going to happen, but we're certainly all on high alert and putting a lot of resources around making sure that we are protecting our institutions and making sure that key institutions in America are in as strong a position as possible. In the event that something occurs, we're as ready as we can be, and we'll help each other out.
Yeah. Finally, Jane, I hope this will be one of what will be a number of interviews as we track your progress. When we come back, if we ever do, are you still going to be trading at 75% of book value?
I think there's tremendous upside in our stock, and I'm looking forward to doing the job that's needed to get the execution done so that it gets realized.
All right. Well, we'll be watching and certainly appreciate your taking time with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David.
Jane Fraser, the CEO of Citigroup. Carl, back to you.
All right, good stuff, David. David mentioned 75%. Historical average on Citi's 88.
Jeez, I can't believe how much money they have to spend, how underinvested they were. That explains a lot to me. Not unlike what Jamie Dimon said. Wow. I mean, it's an eye-opening interview. I mean, that they could be so wrong about how much money had to be spent just to be able to keep the infrastructure up.
Well, I mean, 5 to 6 is not unlike what Dimon said a few weeks ago.
But Brian Moynihan's doing 3 a year. He's got it all under control at Bank of America. I mean, he didn't underinvest. Now, he got hurt over and over again because he was spending all this money. Well, it turned out, you know, better late than some of these guys are doing never, and they're really bulking up.
Yeah.
I think Citi is correctly down, given the fact that
The duration of the spend is what you're thinking?
It's really.
It's an arms race in a way
among
the major banks.
Yeah, and I just think I want to applaud again Moynihan, who saw it coming and got much more digitized far earlier. That's something, by the way, that in Trailblazer, which is Mark Benioff's book, you see it. You see that they just said, you know what, we're not spending enough on this. So they just plowed all the money in. And now Citi has to do that. She got a bad hand. Holy cow.
Yeah.
She had a lot of work to do.
Really quick on Salesforce. Morgan Stanley made a note of your interview with Benioff symbolically from the Ohana floor. We haven't even mentioned Google bringing back employees in April.
But, you know, just to go over what Mark said, I mean, remember, Mark is not in the business of hyping his company when Ukraine's going on. He made that very clear to me. He said he was very uncomfortable saying, hey, things are great, which they are, because of what's going on in the tragedy. And I understand that. I mean, it is very hard to be bullish when you see that Putin is killing people. And for no reason whatsoever, people are dying.
Right. By the way, the Ukrainians have said that talks with the Russians are now in progress as we speak.
And when I'm hearing about Iran, my best source, thank you, I read John Ellis's fantastic newsletter. But close. But, you know, when it comes to Iran, anybody can disable a talk. I've got Verizon tonight after a very good analyst meeting. I know I would like to hear David's thoughts on that because they're not as covered 5G as T-Mobile. And then I've got Block, the old Square. And I think a lot of people are interested in that. This Block Square Cash is doing incredibly well. But how about all these things they're doing with crypto and all the strange cryptos? Blow your nose crypto, I think, is coming out tomorrow.
Yeah, even Twitter looking to decentralize with a bigger crypto presence. That's getting interesting,
well,
too.
Well, you know, Gary Gensler's got his work cut out for
him. We'll see you at 6.
Yep.
Mad Money, of course, with Jim Cramer, 6 p.m. Eastern time.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.